This program may contain explicit language. Also, we have a newsletter coming out. It's at slate.com/gistnews. Now on with the possibly filthy show. It's Friday, August 16th, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Our president projects. It's the I know you are, but what am I presidency. If only it were also the names will never hurt me society. But he puts on other entities that which is festering within. This week, he claimed that he put China on the road to recession. He, of course, said during the campaign that Hillary received help from the Russians and the Ukrainians. Then, of course, there was this chestnut.
Putin, from everything I see, has no respect for this person.
Well, that's because he'd rather have a puppet as president of the United States.
No puppet.
And it's pretty clear.
You're the puppet.
It's pretty clear.
Every outlet except Fox is fake news. Everyone is lying about him. And yesterday, in a speech in New Hampshire, this happened.
That guy's got a serious weight problem. Go home, start exercising.
Of course, Trump did add after that.
Got a bigger problem than I do. Got a bigger problem than all of us.
So maybe he was acknowledging his own, shall we say, portliness, the general girth of the base. But that was the exception. If Ted's lying and Hillary's crooked, what then is Don, I ask? Projecting. He is projecting. Well, today we've seen the largest consequence of a specific type of projection, and that is Trump being undone by the famous, the infamous Mercator projection, which is fueling his stupefying, jumbled, distracted, and distracting ADHD idea. Here's CNN.
The Wall Street Journal was the first to report yesterday, since everyone else is mashed. The president has been discussing the possibility of buying the island of Greenland, purchasing it from Denmark.
Now, you know, Trump likes things that are big. Trump Tower is described by Trump as 68 stories tall, even though it's only 58. That sort of thing. And Greenland, for all these years, has been benefiting from the Mercator projection, which is how the most common maps present as flat, a round thing like the Earth. Because of the Mercator projection, named after the 16th century Flemish geographer Gerardus Mercator, because of this, Greenland appears way bigger on maps than it is in real life. In fact, on maps, it appears to be roughly the same size as Africa. In reality, Greenland's 2 million square kilometers, Africa's 30 million square kilometers. Look, no disrespect to 16th century Flemish geographer Gerardus Mercator. Woe unto anyone who insults a 16th century Flemish geographer. The guy's just trying to educate his fellow countrymen that there's a world out there beyond the horizon that you won't drop off of. So good on him. He did the best he could. But the bigness of Greenland has stuck in the imagination, and it is no doubt factoring into Trump's fancy. You also know that all of this is going absolutely nowhere. Donald Trump is much more likely to acquire a lap band than Lapland, but at least for once, he's caused some head scratching as opposed to, say, some market cratering or a global recession due to his international musings. And that I count as progress. On the show today, the black sheep of Woodstock, the dorks of doo-wop, sha-na-na. Turns out they did all right for themselves. But first, Steve Rushen is a longtime Sports Illustrated writer who is also a memoirist and podcaster. The guy truly delights me. I've loved Steve Rushen for 25 years, but I've never met Steve Rushen until now. I think we got on famously. You be the judge, the author of Knights in White Castle, Steve Rushen. Hey, The Gist is doing a comedy special. The structure of the show will be, I shall invite a trio of comedians on stage. They shall ply their comedy craft, and then we will discuss why they said what they said, how they say what they say. Will they continue to keep saying the things that they said? Also, a special guest. young up-and-coming comedians critiqued by pros like Hari Kondabolu. This will all go down at the Bell House in Brooklyn on Monday, September 16th. Tickets are a quite affordable $20 to see three quite accomplished comedians who alone might charge, I don't know, $22 a night just to see them. 7 p.m. Monday, September 16th, Bell House in Brooklyn. Go to slate.com/live for tickets and info. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. Steve Rushen was probably among my top three favorite Sports Illustrated magazine journalists. I'd go with Gary Smith, Steve Rushen, and Alexander Wolf. And the thing is that they're all vastly different. Alexander Wolf knows a lot about how basketball is actually played. Gary Smith takes a year and a half to do the deepest profile you ever met. And Steve Rushen cracks wise, you know, 4 jokes per paragraph. And it still works for me. These days, what is Sports Illustrated? What is magazine? The point is Steve Rushen still writes. And his new book is Knights in White Castle, a memoir. It's about Steve growing up in Minnesota. And there is a car on the cover. And that car is looking like, what, a Firebird?
Yes.
Yeah. But your last book was, hello, Steve, how are you?
I'm doing well, Mike. How are you?
Good. Your last book was Stingray Afternoons.
That's right.
So, but I never associated you with muscle cars. Like, you don't seem to be a roll your sleeves up and expose your triceps kind of guy. It was just part of growing up in Minnesota?
Nobody is less associated with muscle cars than I am. And I should add that my parents' three favorite SI writers, Alex Wolf is number one.
Yes.
I don't know where I rank.
He's a lovely guy.
He's a great guy, yeah. And he got me my job at Sports Illustrated. So my parents, who thought I would be on their couch for the rest of my life, are eternally indebted to him. But no, I'm definitely not a muscle car guy. This was the kind of car that you would see in the parking lot at White Castle when I was in middle school and high school, and that was our hangout.
Now, Knights in White Castle, this is based on a Moody Blues song, and I, just by reading the book and your love of Van Halen and knowing what I know about you, it's a funny title, but you don't seem like a Moody Blues guy.
No, you know, Knights in White Satin, the previous book, Stingray Afternoons, was set in the 70s when I was a little kid. And Knights in White Satin still looms large in my memory from that time because we got a stereo in the basement with the graphic equalizer bars that were the only light in a dark basement. And we would sort of like holding your hand across a candle flame, we would see how long we could listen to these terrifying songs. And if you listen to the spoken word portion of Knights in White Castle, breathe deep the gathering gloom, watch lights fade from every room. As a kid in a dark basement, it's terrifying. And I could never make it through that. The same thing with 10cc, Big Boys Don't Cry. Big Boys Don't Cry. There were some of the, and in the first LP that I remember having in the house, my oldest brother had Hotel California.
Yeah.
And I don't know what was happening in that satanic hotel where they were stabbing it with their steely knives and trying to kill the beast. And you can check out, but you can't leave. But it freaked me out. And even songs that were sort of more adult, melancholy, Cats in the Cradle, you know.
Oh,
I was
a
kid.
Yeah.
My dad traveled, but he was still there and played catch with me and stuff. But that just bummed me out that poor little kid with the dad and they couldn't play catch. Yeah. So, you know, the title works as White Castle was our hangout, but it still does have that residue of the 70s when I was traumatized by that song.
Now, to be serious for a second, I do think in writing, it might seem from the outside that when you get super specific, super local, what you're doing is excluding others. But I find that there's this weird thing where if you do it well, In the specificity is the universality. And I don't exactly know why that is, except I think as human beings, we make the analogy to our version of that. So when you're writing about Dino Cicerelli and the North Stars, I'm probably experiencing it as Mike Bossy and the Islanders.
Exactly. There you go. And people are also, you know, to be a little serious, I think everybody is insecure. And the more they should seem to not be insecure, the more likely they are to be. And you think of like the biggest movie stars and things. And part of that is people wondering, am I weird? You know, have other people experienced this? Right. You know, was anybody else, you know, trying to see Scrambled, you know, Cinemax in their basement? And I think when you discover that other people were doing the same thing, whether it was across the world or not, you feel a little less alone and a little less, you know, weird. And it applies in any age. The technology has changed, you know. My cable is my kid's YouTube, whatever it is. But they're having similar kind of human experiences that I had in Bloomington and you had on Long Island or wherever.
Did you read memoirs like the two that this reminded me of were Russell Baker's on Baltimore and Bob Greene's on Bexley, Ohio? Because to me, Bexley, Ohio is a place that I'd never considered. And yes, it became so alive and real after reading that.
I know of both memoirs. I haven't read either of them. I have read a bunch of memoirs and I don't seek them out. But, J.R. Moringer's The Tender Bar, where he grew up, on Long Island.
That's really good. Manhasset. Yeah.
It's great. Yeah, it's great.
Which is weird. I grew up, you know, 20 miles from there, but I would never go into a bar near the railroad station, and it's a whole different world.
That had, you know, a really compelling setting there,
yeah.
You know, being a kid in a bar. But he was also, a lot of it was about being a kid. And I remember what I remember, and I read it years ago, but I remember from that was they had a bicentennial couch. They had like a red, white, and blue bicentennial specific couch. And it just brought me back to the bicentennial when I was 9 years old was such a big deal. And at around the same time, we were converting to the metric system, you know, talk about an 11-day tenure, the metric system.
Yeah.
And your pencil box now at school had, you know, centimeters on it. I had to struggle to come up with centimeters. I've already forgotten what they were.
We fought that.
Yeah, we fought.
To me, that's so entwined with Jimmy Carter.
Totally.
Like, it's probably a better idea that America hated.
Exactly.
That's the Carter presidency.
But that sort of said to me, here's another guy who grew up at the same time,
right.
You know, and you think of yourself. You always think of yourself as probably 10 or 20 years younger than you are as you get older. But you never think of the time that you grew up as kind of a distant past now. You know, when I was a kid, in a Happy Days was this huge show and American Graffiti, and they were 15 years in the past. You know, Happy Days in 1974 was about 1959, I guess, you know?
Right.
And now 15 years ago, to me, at 52, seems like 19 seconds ago. And so it takes some kind of acceptance that my childhood in the 70s and the 80s was when I was a kid in the 70s, that would have been what the 1930s was for people in the 70s,
right?
You know, a long time ago, a black and white age with different kinds of cars and telephones.
There's always, I think there's a reliable nostalgia lag, and it follows us like a shadow at about a 15 to 20 year interval. And the reason for that is, I think, people of that age who are in the time that the becomes the popular time to be nostalgiaized in the current time is usually when the parents of the current time were kids. And what my theory is that, so the 90s is being the subject of nostalgia now in Full House. So my theory is it's all about parenting and it's all about looking at the world through your kids' eyes and remembering, when I was 10, this was going on. And then if you get that media that portrays life when you were 10, it's really resonant. Because logically, I mean, you know, as the American lifespan has been expanding, we should be nostalgia for a whole bunch of times.
Right.
But 50s nostalgia doesn't really exist. I talked about how the moon landing, I think, was a little bit under-celebrated given how freaking gigantic it was.
Right.
But my God, 90s nostalgia, because that's where the parents are.
That's absolutely the case. And even when I sat down to write a memoir, recalling my childhood, it's in the present tense, and you know, I wanted you to feel like, you know, you're living it now, even though it was the 70s or the 80s. I was looking at stuff that my kids do now and remembering, I did that same thing. My son would lie in bed in the summertime, does it now, and count his bug bites like he's rereading the day in Braille. You know, I've got 27. You know, yesterday I had 20. You know, look at this one; it's on my ankle. I can't. And I would do the same thing, but I'd forgotten about that for years, you know, and just kind of enumerating your bug bites and or picking the little thin, super thin sheet of ice would form on the inside of my bedroom window when I was a kid in Minnesota. And I remember picking that up, but it would get suctioned to the window and trying to peel that off. And that made me think of putting the side of my palm print on the bus window when it was iced up in the wintertime. And then you would make feet. Like you could put the side of your fist on the window and that would make a little footprint looking shape.
Right,
and then
right.
With your fingertip, you would make five toes. And this just led this train of thought that started with stuff that my kids do now. And my 12-year-old had a friend over yesterday, and I have in my office a working banana yellow rotary dial telephone that I got off of eBay, and it was retrofit to work. And it doesn't work well, but it's a fuzzy line, but it's our landline, a rotary dial phone. And they were bored on the summer day, and they picked up the phone and tried to figure out how to dial from that phone to the friend's cell phone. And, you know, do we dial one before the area code? And they got a recorded message saying you must dial one. And eventually they were able to connect the banana yellow phone to the cell phone. And they were just like amazed. And I said
to shore radio.
I said to my wife, this is what like one of those, you know, hand crank telephones where you had the receiver that you'd put up to your ear and you'd hold the other part to your mouth.
Ahoy, ahoy.
Ahoy, ahoy. Exactly. That's what it was like when I was a kid. It was something from a completely different world. But of course, the ahoy, ahoy telephone was a lot closer to the telephone that I had as a kid, the Ma Bell banana yellow one, than that Ma Bell telephone is to what the kids think of as a phone now, you know, their iPhone.
So I listened to the Ball and Chain podcast, which you and your wife, who we should say is Rebecca Lobo, is one of the greatest basketball players of all time, UConn, Liberty, etc. And you talk a lot about your kids and boredom and how much joy you take in any time they're not on electronic devices. That is a constant theme over the 80 episodes.
Well, having just taken them in a minivan through Southern California, and you know, you'd say, look at that. It's the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
It's people, these are, you know, you'd have to pay $20 million to have a house here and to look at that. Could you please look up from your Temple Run or whatever game you're playing to look at that, you know? Yeah. We flew out here to look at that. And so anytime we can get them off of those things, and it has to be forcibly. We went for a hike in Runyon Canyon in Los Angeles. The kids had no interest. They sat on the first park bench they could find. They sat down with their arms crossed and just kind of frowned out at the Hollywood Hills. And I remember doing that as a kid. We went on a California trip and we had to see the swallows returning to the mission at San Juan Capistrano. We didn't want to do that. We didn't want to go to Colonial Williamsburg, you know? Did anybody as a kid enjoy the butter churning exhibition at Colonial Williamsburg?
I have proof. I mean, I think we could prove that they didn't, because tricorner hats never came back.
Never came back.
Yeah.
And you were lucky if you got to buy like the souvenir tricorner hat. We just wanted to go to the Holodome swimming pool at the Holiday Inn and inhale that chlorine. But so I think in the same way that Every suburban house should have a room that you're not allowed to go into that just has the vacuum tracks in it and maybe the plastic covered couch. Every kid
should be in near mint condition.
Exactly. Yes. Every we're saving for company, but even company never gets to sit on it. It's just a museum.
Saving for good company.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. And if only we had good company. And in the same way, every kid should be made to go on at least one excruciatingly boring part of a vacation where dad reads out the historical markers, because I'm at the age now where I do stop at the historical markers to look and to read them. And, oh, this is kids.
Yeah.
Did you know that William Mulholland first brought water to, you know,
some of them do need an editor though.
I was
in Hudson and there was a historical marker saying, this is the place where the first place in America where a hotel was built on the site of a former movie theater. Like, are we doing this now? We're doing Mad Libs? Yes. Like, this is the first hardware store that used to be a veterinarian clinic. Okay.
I think they probably have a tie-in with the plaque industry, the local Big historical
plaque,
society.
That's right.
Big plaque, yes. That's either a dentistry thing or... But we were in California, and we saw a plaque at a hotel that was one of the nation's largest wooden structures. Really? You know,
yeah.
I mean...
Look, I don't want to brag, but...
Yeah. Even if it's the largest, it's probably not. And where I live in Connecticut, Lake Compounds, the amusement park, they've got little historical markers around the park now. And it is a historic amusement park, and they've got an old wooden roller coaster and all this stuff. But they have a plaque, a marker, where Guns N' Roses didn't show up for a concert in, you know, 1987 or something. They were supposed to be there, and they didn't show. How do we even know that this is the spot where they didn't show?
You know? It's all the spot where they didn't show
up. And yet,
do we have a vapor trail of Slash?
And I took a picture of that historic spot.
Do you think they meant that with irony?
I certainly hope so. But I feel a kind of, you know, especially, you know, just driving around Los Angeles and, you know, so many spots where, you know, the actress flung herself off the H in the Hollywood sign in 1923, or, you know, you pass the Chateau Marmont and kids, you don't know who John Belushi is, but that's where he died. I will stop and gawp at any one of those things.
Right. So let me ask you one other Rebecca question. Do you think that she respects your craft as much as you respect hers?
Well, I think she respects my craft of writing books. Now, my craft as a sports writer is different because she has a completely different – she has had to deal with sports writers, you know, her whole life. And she has great respect for many of them and she
You're just not one of them?
Well, good question. I mean, there's too much other stuff associated with that that I can't separate the sports writer part of it. But we definitely have different perspectives. And when we started dating and she was still playing in the WNBA and – you know, I remember this vividly. For some reason, Roger Clemens was on SportsCenter. Roger Clemens came up and she said, "Roger Clemens, he is such a nice guy." And I just started laughing. I said, "We have had very different experiences of Roger Clemens. And frankly, we've had, you know, different experiences of just about everybody." I remember being at a Liberty game and she wasn't playing. She was injured. And after the game, she was still in warm-ups. A guy sitting courtside, Barry Bonds, the Giants were in town to play the Mets, walked across the court and gave her a hug. And I was like, gosh, you know, I've been around Barry Bonds plenty. I never got a hug from him. So two very, very different experiences. and
well, that's game-recognized game.
Yeah, right. But she sees the best. She literally sees the best in humanity because, you know, she's exposed to the best of these people.
But then again, if Jackie McMullen came up to both of you, she'd probably hug Rebecca.
Well, Jackie McMullen has come up to both of us. We've been in plenty of places together and rightly so. So I find myself, you know, people coming up and saying, you know, could I get a picture? I take the phone from them and take a picture of Rebecca and that person. And one time we were at O'Hare waiting in line at McDonald's at O'Hare, changing planes to go somewhere. And a guy came up, older guy, and said, "Could I get a picture?" And I said, you know, "Sure, give me your phone." He says, "No, I want you too, Andre Agassi." And so I was flattered and I'll sign anything. So, it doesn't have to be my name.
Andre Agassi was 6'5".
Yes, exactly. But he's just as bald as Andre. So
Steve Rushen is a longtime Sports Illustrated writer. You should check out his podcast with his wife, Ball and Chain. His new memoir is called Knights in White Castle. Steve, great to meet you.
Mike, thank you so much.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Sha-na-na played Woodstock. It's one of those cultural cross currents that always obsessed me and always struck me as quite off. You know these kind. Elvis meets Nixon, Joe Namath's on the Brady Bunch, the insane clown posse gets mesmerized by magnets. It was clear who's on the goofier side of those interactions, but I've been rethinking Sha-na-na as of late. Like the moon landing, Woodstock's 50th anniversary is prominent, but not as culturally ubiquitous as I'd have thought compared to, say, the 20th or the 30th. Because if you're in your 20s at Woodstock, you're in your 70s now, and culture is not made for you anymore. It's okay. You've had a good ride. So maybe it's because the reverence for Woodstock has faded that Sha-na-na, having played Woodstock, is no longer seen purely as a bunch of clowns romping through the sacred temple. The temple has been overturned a bit. And I've done a lot of research into Sha-na-na. Too much research. Sha-na-na is interesting. Is Sha-na-na good? Sure! They sang Blue Moon and Earth Angel and Get a Job. These are important songs. Sha-na-na does certainly respectable versions. That's what they were doing. They were doing cover songs of music from just a decade earlier. There were dozens of them. They wore greaser outfits and gold lame outfits, and they danced, and they adopted characters. So most of that stuff I just said, the gold lame and the dozens of members and the choreography and character, it's kind of like Beyoncé, isn't it? It's maybe a little closer to our current cultural moment than what was going on at Woodstock, an indistinguishable stream of hippie fringe vest guys like the Keith Hartley Band or Quill or the Incredible String Band. Yeah, man, they all jammed at Woodstock. Let me pause for another explanation of Sha-na-na for all our listeners under the age of, say, 40, who might be saying up until this point, Sha-wa-ha? Sha-na-na refers to these guys.
In the beginning, there was nothing but rock. Then, somebody invented the wheel. And things just began to roll. Did you ever hear a
team? To an 8-year-old Mike Pesca, they were just entertainers on TV who sang 50 songs. I liked 50 songs. They did stupid comedy skits. I like stupid comedy skits. They had a lead singer named Bowser who did this flexing thing with his biceps. Seemed to have no practical purpose except for screaming, trademark. It was a time when Barbara Mandrell and the Mandrell sisters had a variety show, where Donnie and Marie had a variety show, where George Plimpton and the Paris Review had a variety show. Okay, I made that up. It was some sketches, some songs. My parents dubbed it acceptable non-trash TV, and this was really important in embedding itself in my consciousness. It was on. That was really important back in the late 70s, early 80s, being on. Years earlier, before they got the show, Sha-na-na had indeed played Woodstock. It was a genre mismatch, but the story goes like this. They were students at Columbia. They were part of a glee club type group, the Kingsmen. And for one show only, they adopted this greaser shtick. And it was quite popular. They jumped on the bandwagon. They booked some gigs downtown. And when they were there, they delighted Jimi Hendrix. Their 8th or 9th ever gig was Woodstock. They were fine. They're in the Woodstock movie. They were the last group before Jimi Hendrix closed down the concert with that rendition of the Star Spangled Banner we all know today. What fascinated me was what became of the Sha-na-na-ians. Now, the group experienced, as musicians do, as I suppose any group of a number of people, over three dozen people do, they experienced some overdoses, some deaths by natural causes. A few kept at their musical careers. But the CVs of some of them are really astounding. So when their syndicated show was on the air, they did the intro credits. Denny, that Denny That is future Yale Law School graduate Frederick Dennis Green. He went on to become the vice president of production and features at Columbia Pictures. And then he wound up teaching at the Oregon School of Law and for a long time at Dayton School of Law. An extremely accomplished person in the field of film and the law. Santini, who you heard mentioned there, well, that's Scott Powell, orthopedic surgeon who went on to become the team physician for the United States women's national soccer team. He's on the medical staff at the Keck School of Medicine at USC. Also playing at Woodstock, original Sha'na'na member Alan Cooper. Today, he is the provost of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, a professor of Judaism. There was Joe Witkin, the original keyboard player, who also went on to become an ER physician. And then there was Bruno. That's Bruce Clark. If you go to Texas Tech and look up the Paul Whitfield Horn Professor of Literature and Science, you will come across Bruce Clark. Check out the Sha'na'na member, Bruno Clark's new work, Post-Human Metamorphosis, Narrative, and Systems. Oh, the endowed chairs just keep on coming. The group was founded by and choreographed by George Leonard, who went on to teach English at Yale and to be a professor at San Francisco State. And then there is his brother, Robert Leonard. The old NBC show Forensic Files tells us of Robert Leonard's current calling in the creepiest possible way.
The writer claimed he killed Charlene when she tried to end their 9-month affair.
She wanted to break it off, so I broke her neck. This is the 5th woman I've killed. I'm getting good at it. Cops have no idea how easy it is to pin the husband when they only look there.
Investigators sent the letter, along with the purported stalker letters, to forensic linguist Dr. Robert Leonard, who had an unusual background. He was a founding member of the rock and roll group Sha'na'na.
What he's saying is that Robert Leonard killed that lady. No! Robert Leonard is a professor of forensic linguistics at Hofstra. He helps catch serial killers and murderers. The question I kept having is it a fluke? Or is it understandable that so many members of the Sha'na Nation went on to illustrious careers? Was it that their name was taken from the lyrics of the song Get a Job by the Silhouettes?
Dip, 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 dip. Sha'na'na, 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 Sha'na'na.
Two other factors. One, as I said, the original members of Sha'na'na all went to Columbia. Big advantage going to an Ivy League school. And then there's this. Wikipedia lists 42 current or former members of Sha'na'na. If you take 42 of anyone, a few will achieve glory, a few will be left behind, a few will only be remembered for their Sha'na'nanigans. Of course, that said, there are 21 former members of the Butterfield Blues Band, and none became doctors or professors, though some just kept on rocking. One's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, one or two are. But the Butterfield Blues Band is Sha'na'na, not the subject of this spiel. I do think, however, that Sha'na'na, in general, should be thought of something as less than a punchline, maybe as more of a curious launching pad for quite a few careers that greatly added to society, even if they were grossly out of place 50 years ago on Yasgur's farm. And that's it for today's show. The Gist was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader, who founded a band a while ago to celebrate the glories of the majestic river in Ireland, but Sha'na'na ran into copyright troubles. The Gist, to quote the cable sent out by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, January 1979, Sha'na'na. Oopra depra dooparoo, and thanks for listening.